Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ambassador David Mack, who served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Near East Affairs from 1990 to 1993, and as U.S. Ambassador to the United Arab Emirates from 1986 to 1989. His diplomatic assignments included Iraq, Jordan, Jerusalem, Lebanon, Libya, and Tunisia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ambassador David Mack.
I'm happy to be with you and your audience.
And Tunisia, of course, is back in the news. It was the first country in the Arab Spring, to bring about the Arab Spring, I should say. And the opposition leader was shot. He'd received a lot of death threats for his outspoken criticism of Tunisia's Islamic-led government. And the shooting has prompted sufficient outrage that Tunisia's ruling Islamic government has dissolved parliament and promised rapid elections. Give us a sense of this struggle, which seems to be sort of going on throughout the Middle East, even in Israel, between the secular and religious. It's certainly going on in Egypt as well. How do you see these forces reconciling?
Well, in Tunisia, to be specific, there's always been a divided population, with a very significant minority of the population being relatively westernized, fairly well educated, and often educated in French schools or even university education in France. And they have tended to be a population that was secular, that embraced the various westernizing and modernizing reforms of the leader of Tunisian independence from France, Habib Bourguiba. They pushed things around. I mean, the great mass of the population tended to be more traditional, less enthusiastic about some of the westernizing reforms, but they were kept down and suppressed to a very great degree until the overthrow of Prime Minister Ben Ali, or President Ben Ali, who was Bourguiba's successor. President Ben Ali had ruled in a very authoritarian way. He was a tough cop. I knew him when I was in Tunisia, and he was basically the top policeman. He didn't have much use for democracy, and he was particularly harsh in the repression of Ennahda and similar groups that tended to express the more traditionalist side of the Tunisian population. And to a degree, there's been a reaction against secularism as one of the outcomes of the revolution that took place a couple of years ago.
Now, of course, the revolution took place largely against a kleptocrat who had a rather sort of, shall I say, tacky family who were just living ostentatiously off the fat of the land. But that's not to say that the secular forces that have followed the 2010 revolution, which sparked the Arab Spring, are anything like that. So give us a sense then of how the secular religious divide is now, given that this Islamist-led government has, the opposition figure who was just shot was highly critical of. How do his forces stack up against the current Islamic government, who have just called for an election?
Oh, I think that the forces of the recently assassinated secular leader, who's one of several, he's not the only one or necessarily the principal one, but I think that they represent a very strong and important minority, but I would have to say it's probably a minority of the Tunisian population. I think you're correct in characterizing the Ben Ali regime as a kleptocracy, but it would be incorrect to overlook the broader social conflict between the secular and westernized minority of the Tunisian population and the majority, which tends to be more traditional, had embraced a couple of parties, notably Ennahda, which was an Islamist party that had its primary identification with Islam, but they didn't tend toward extremism. They tended more toward the Turkish model, a government that would return a greater degree of traditionalism. But they at least nominally embraced the principles of democratic reform. I think that there has been considerable excesses by the government, particularly suppression in a fairly heavy-handed way of some demonstrations. But there have clearly also been excesses by some of the groups who have been unwilling to accept the verdict of the elections and proceed and try to work within a system in which the dominant party would be, and not the Islamist party.
Again, I'm speaking with Ambassador David Mack, who served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Near East Affairs and as U.S. Ambassador to the United Arab Emirates. He also served in Iraq, Jordan, Jerusalem, Lebanon, Libya, and Tunisia. And we're talking about the assassination in Tunisia of the opposition leader, a secular leader, which has caused the Islamist government to dissolve itself and call for speedy elections. However, there is, as well as the ruling Islamist government, there is this Salafist group, and the same exists in Tunisia, by the way, and I believe it was entirely funded almost by the Saudis and from the Gulf. They came in second in the Egyptian parliamentary elections to the shock of everybody. But they also seem to have a cadre, a very active cadre in Tunisia, where they have prevented several concerts from taking place and theaters, performances from taking place. And they've apparently, back in September, they sacked the U.S. embassy. So give us a sense of where they stand in the political lexicon. They're obviously to the right of the ruling Islamist party.
Right. The Salafi groups do not accept a government based upon democratic principles and a constitutional democracy and elections, as is the case with Ennahda, the ruling party. And I thought it was very wise of Ennahda to form a government that included several of the secular parties, rather than forming a government to the right of center that would have included the Salafi parties. This, of course, has outraged the Salafi groups. It's one of the reasons why they sacked the U.S. embassy or the U.S. school and caused damage at the U.S. embassy. And they've been put down with a fairly firm hand. I would differ, perhaps, in the degree to which a large part of the Tunisian population might care that much about theater and the arts. I think, frankly, it is a very articulate group. They obviously communicate fairly well with the Western media, but it does not represent the broad Tunisian public, who are far more concerned with the high cost of basic commodities and the lack of jobs. The Tunisian revolution, to a certain extent, like the Egyptian revolution and others, has come at a time when we're in a bit of a worldwide recession. And Tunisia, in particular, was very dependent upon its economic relationship with Europe. 80% of its trade went to Europe, and Western Europe provided an outlet for surplus Tunisian labor. This is no longer the case, and the recession in Europe means that the Europeans are not about to help Tunisia at a time when it really needs help in terms of trade preferences that might create a lot of jobs back in Tunisia for the great mass of the Tunisian people.
Well, the assassination of the opposition leader in Tunisia has prompted French President François Hollande to say, quoting, "This murder deprives Tunisia of one of its most courageous and free voices." Now, Ennahda, the ruling party, its leader, Rachel Ghannouchi, he denied any involvement by his party in the killing, and he's pretty emphatic about it, and it actually seems unlikely that their fingerprints would be on it. But you could speculate that maybe it was Salafist, right? What's your sense? I know you're speculating.
That is certainly possible. I mean, frankly, I think it's the Salafi groups that are far more likely to use violence to pursue their political ends than is true of people on the left, even the far left. So I think that Ian, I agree. I think that that is a appropriate speculation and very possibly correct. I think it's to the credit of this and not the government, which has handled the situation somewhat better, I would say, than the Morsi government in Egypt. I think it's to their credit that they are forming a small government of technocrats to govern the country in an apolitical way and going very promptly to new elections. This will give an outlet for liberal parties. It will be a test. Are they prepared to do the hard work of grassroots organizing and come up with good candidates in the election? Because they could gain ground. There could be a certain amount of sympathy vote for them as a result of this assassination. I think it's an opportunity for them. I doubt very much whether gains will be made by the Salafis. I think they may have hit the high water mark. But any government in Tunisia is going to have to meet the basic test of creating jobs and keeping a lid on the consumer, the costs for the poor level, moderate income people and low income people in terms of basic commodities. That's going to be the test of any government. Not, I'm afraid, whether they provide a free press or whether they provide liberties of cultural expression. Important as those are, and I certainly support them, they're ones that are really not as critical as the economic tests.
So, again, I'm speaking with Ambassador David Mack, who served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Near East Affairs and as U.S. Ambassador to the United Arab Emirates. He also served in Iraq, Jordan, Jerusalem, Lebanon, Libya, and Tunisia. And given your broad experience in the Middle East, Ambassador David Mack, I'd be interested in getting your sense of how I see a certain symmetry here between these struggles of just what's happening now in Tunisia, about which we've been speaking, but also what's been going on in Cairo and in throughout the major cities in Egypt. And even in the Israeli elections recently, the secular versus the religious divide seemed to be what, in many ways, that election was about. So let's start with Egypt then. You're saying that Morsi's not handling this as well as it's being handled in Tunisia. What can Morsi do to those young secular students and leftists and others who really propel that revolution and feel that they've been cheated by a backroom deal between the military and the Muslim Brotherhood? And now you have Morsi cracking down in the way that the military used to crack down. So it seems to me that his legitimacy is on the wane.
I think he has done a poor job of governance, but I'm not so certain that that I would have described his poor governance exactly the same way. I think he has taken some steps that would alienate international financial circles that would be prepared to invest in the Egyptian economy. I would caution that this should not be seen as a contest of an authoritarian government against people wanting freedom so much as it is a contest of a fairly inept government at a time when people are demanding a better life. It's very easy for us in the West and for our media to lock on to those who are very articulate, particularly in English, and present a case that makes them appear as romantic revolutionaries against an authoritarian government. And for a few months, that was very much the conversation that was going on in Egypt itself. But after about a year, people are saying, if this is democracy, who wants it? Because we thought that democracy would give us a chance for a better life. Most Egyptians are not out there demonstrating for a free press. Most Egyptians have to put bread on the table every night. They can't even afford to be away from their jobs. And there's a certain impatience, I think, on the broad public. And this is very much in the case of Egypt. An opposition that can manage to stage public demonstrations and dominate the cyberspace, but doesn't do the hard work of organizing for elections
and developing grassroots support and bringing out voters at the time of an election.
Well, it seems to me, though, that maybe you've pinned down what the real issues are here in this entire region. In fact, the entire Mediterranean. If you go anti-clockwise around the Mediterranean and just take the figures of youth unemployment, starting in Morocco, where I believe it's close to 50%, then Algeria, where it's about 40%, Tunisia, where it's about 30%, Egypt, where it's about 40%, then even in Israel, there's a significant amount of youth unemployment. Syria, of course, is in the midst of a civil war. Then Turkey seems to be doing well in that regard. Greece, though, has something like 40% youth unemployment. Italy has about 30% youth unemployment. France, I think, around 20%. And Spain, around 50%, or actually 55%. So isn't this a broader challenge, both in the northern Mediterranean and the southern Mediterranean?
Oh, I think it is. I think that all of this started out first in Tunisia and then in Egypt with a big focus on the rights of free people against an authoritarian government, very much of a political and cultural focus. But I think increasingly it's becoming a question of the haves against the have-nots, and the governments in some cases, and I think you've pointed to the successful cases like in Turkey, but elsewhere, governments often doing a poor job of providing for people's daily bread and job creation. Now, that's partly because of the global economic problems, but the countries in this region, south of Europe, have a different kind of demography than most Western European countries do, with a much greater youth bulge. And young people are less prepared to accept some of the economic privations, perhaps, than their elders were.
Well, just in closing, Ambassador David Mack, is the secular religious divide that was manifested in the recent Israeli election, is that significant? It's not the same as what we've been talking about, but it seemed to be significant in the rise of this party of Yair Lapid, who seemed to come out of nowhere and came in second.
I think in the whole of the Middle East and North Africa, you have two basic conflicts that are going to dominate. One is the secular religious divide, and I think you're quite right pointing out that the Israel, despite its economic prosperity and relative security, is feeling that problem with a great deal of intensity. But the other issue is the question of basic economics. Where are jobs going to come from? And at a time when we know that global wheat prices are on the rise and a country like Egypt is the largest importer of wheat in the entire world, how are people going to get fed? And what seemed to be a revolution for human rights in Egypt and in Tunisia is increasingly going to be demands from the have-nots to have a greater economic security.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Ambassador David Mack.
You're welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with Ambassador David Mack, who served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Near East Affairs and as U.S. Ambassador to the United Arab Emirates, and also served in Iraq, Jordan, Jerusalem, Lebanon, Libya, and Tunisia. And this has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.